welcome back to the second half of Earth First Radio. I'm still Uncle Dennis, and there's still more important information coming up, so please do keep that pencil and recycled paper handy.
And now let's get to our editorial for today. This one's entitled, The Changing Face of Sierra Brings New Breed of Clear-Cut Foes, and written by Stuart Leavenworth of the Sacramento Bee. California's logging battles often produce some repetitious moments, activists chaining themselves to trees, timber executives railing about extremists, but in the state's latest fight over forests, tree huggers aren't so easy to recognize. Across the Sierra Nevada, old timber towns are being transformed by small businesses, retirees, and urban refugees. Now many of them are organizing against the state's largest private landowner, Sierra Pacific Industries, which plans to cut 1 million acres of its forests over the next century, or one out of every 40 acres of forest in California. From Shasta to Calaveras counties, unlikely activists are gathering petitions on networking, worried that SPI cuts will hurt not only bird nests, but also their nest eggs. We're not just a bunch of environmental junkies, said Len Hines, a 67-year-old real estate agent in El Dorado County, where Sierra Pacific Industries plans to clear-cut scenic Jenkinson Lake. We are out here working for the community, and we want to have a voice. Never before active on logging issues, residents like Hines reflect a demographic shift in the Sierra that could have profound implications for Sierra Pacific Industries, which owns 1.5 million acres from Yosemite to Mount Shasta. In the past, timber industries have tried to dismiss protesters as radicals who are out of touch with average Americans, and often they were right. But as they get older and more restless, average Californians are increasingly moving to the mountains, establishing businesses and settling into subdivisions. Many of them are now worried that their mountains will be scalped. In Nevada County, where SPI plans clear cuts near two forks of the Yuba River, businesses and county supervisors have urged state lawmakers to establish logging rules that more accurately reflect the changing values of communities. In the Calaveras County town of Arnold, residents have held rallies, gathered petitions, and stitched a quilt to depict the 49 tracts Sierra Pacific Industries plans to log in the area, including one planned near a popular state park. Some of the oppositions include realtors, shop owners, and owners of the local country club. SPI officials say their opposition consists of, quote, a relatively small number of people making a lot of noise, but others disagree. This issue has galvanized people like nothing I've ever seen, said Calaveras County Supervisor Marita Calloway, a retired PG&E manager. With an elevation and population of about 4,000, Arnold is an old sawmill town that typifies the transitions of the Sierra. Weathered bait shops stand side by side with Tony galleries and New Age shops, which try customers with promises of whole-life therapies. Residents say they can live with selective logging practiced by the previous owner of Arnold's surrounding timberlands, Georgia Pacific. But about 5 years ago, SPI started barring Georgia Pacific's lands and introduced a new style of forestry. This year, SPI filed plans to log tracts near Calaveras Big Tree State Park, the town's main portion, and White Rock Lake, the town's drinking reservoir. Under SPI's preferred logging method, crews generally clear tracts of 10 to 20 acres, haul out the logs, burn the stumps, spray herbicides, then replant. Like a bomb hit, said Bunny Firebaugh, a 69-year-old resident of Arnold, referring to some of SPI's ongoing clear cuts in the area. You can't just cut down everything, put in a pine plantation, and call it a forest. Sierra Pacific officials acknowledge their clear cuts aren't pretty, but they say the cuts are necessary to clear out scraggly, previously logged forests so SPI can replant and grow millions of faster-growing pines. Tim Feller, Sierra Pacific Industries district manager in Grass Valley, says Californians continue to have a big appetite for wood. He also says the company has been careful to comply with California's relatively strict logging rules, which limit clear cuts to 20 acres and 40 acres with exceptions. Quote, a lot of this is coming from professional forest activist groups, said Feller. They shut down logging on national forests, and now they're coming after us, unquote. Based in Anderson, just out of Redding, California, Sierra Pacific Industries was once a little-known long timber company. But over the past decade, the family-run firm has gone on a buying spree led by 71-year-old Archie Aldous Red Emerson. Now it is one of the nation's largest private landowners, owning one out of every 3 acres of the timber industry land in California. In a 100-year plan unveiled this year, Emerson announced SPI plans to clear-cut 70% of its 1.5 million acres. Emerson routinely has interviews, but friends and state officials describe him as an unassuming billionaire with considerable political clout. In July, Emerson held a party for Governor Gray Davis that raised $129,000 for the governor's reelection campaign. The company has also had a hand in setting timber policy through a seat on the Board of Forestry. Employees credit Emerson for securing a sustainable timber base at a time when logging is decreasing on public lands. "Red's an amazing guy," said Ed Bond, SPI's manager of human resources. Quote, he recognized early that on that the Forest Service is not interested in expanding its timber sales, so he begged and borrowed to buy the land we now own. For Southern Pacific Industries and many state officials, own is the operative word. Unlike previous battles over public timber sales, SPI is now clear-cutting its own land, not national forests. It's a point that resonates with SPI supporters such as Lee Pendleton, a 63-year-old retired accountant from Grass Valley. Having moved from L.A. to Nevada County 6 years ago, Pendleton says he's sick of, quote, damn liberals, unquote, decrying clear cuts, even as they build wood decks on their houses and, quote, drive around in their big polluting cars, unquote. Pendleton says SPI should do what it wants with its land as long as it stays within the law. Quote, I'm against what timber companies did in Washington, where you could drive 20 miles from Yakima or Seattle and see completely denuded mountains, says Pendleton, who has organized a petition drive in support of SPI. Here, if they cut 20 acres, people have a fit, unquote. Others see it differently. A few weeks ago, Mike Tony walked out of his house near Cedar Ridge in rural Nevada County and drove down a bumpy dirt road. Within minutes, he came to a steep hillside of charred stumps and barren ground where thistle competed with pine seedlings. He got back in his truck, drove a quarter mile down the road, and came across another SPI clear cut. This is what they call sustainable forestry, said Tony, looking at acres of stumps and seedlings. I guarantee you, the slope of this hill is more than 50%. In California's 256-page book of forest practice rules, the clear cuts are legal. The rules prevent property owners from logging trees within certain distances of fish-bearing streams, but don't limit the steepness of hillsides where clear cuts can occur. Louis Blumberg, a deputy director for the California Department of Forestry and Fire Protection, says state officials are now weighing whether its rules are adequate to deal with the unprecedented increase of clear cuts in this Sierra. Quote, we recognize the public has concerns about clear cuts, said Blumberg, but the professional foresters have told us that clear cutting is an acceptable technique at the proper place and at the proper rate. Our job is to make sure that whatever method is used does not degrade the state resources, unquote. Some say such degradation is inevitable as SPI clear cuts 10,000 acres a year. Quote, the question isn't whether there will be impact, but how much the impact will be, said Jerry Franklin, a University of Washington forest ecology professor who has long studied the Sierra Nevada. Franklin says the steep slopes and loose soils of the Sierra make the region especially sensitive to clear cuts. SPI officials say their logging practices mimic the natural blowdowns and small fires that historically opened patches of the Sierra. That's nonsense, said Franklin, who contributed to the 1996 Sierra Nevada Ecosystem Project, a research project sponsored partly by the University of California, Davis. Quote, in the Sierra, nature operated at a much smaller spatial scale than 20 acres, so it's not very honest to suggest that this is modeled on some kind of natural regime, unquote. To get a handle on the consequences, the Sierra Club and other groups urged state lawmakers this summer to suspend clear-cutting statewide for 2 years while a commission studies alternative logging practices. To drum up support, Firebaugh and two other Calaveras County residents stitched together a quilt that depicts SPI's clear cuts. For a while, the quilt hung in the office of Assemblyman Fred Keeley, a Santa Cruz Democrat who authored the clear-cut bill. But their needlework didn't win the day. Position from the timber industry, the Keeley bill died in the final days of the legislature. Proponents are now considering a ballot proposition that would ban clear-cutting on private land and have planned a new round of protests. Activists from the group Yuba Nation suspended themselves above two trees on Sierra Pacific property near Graniteville recently, where SPI has won state approval to clear-cut 350 acres on various separate tracts. An activist demonstrated at a meeting of the State Board of Forestry, which is under pressure to further limit logging near salmon streams on the north coast. SPI officials say that demonstrations show how extremists are setting the agenda on clear cuts, but don't tell that to Lou Hines. A retired schoolteacher from San Francisco, Hines and his wife moved 7 years ago to Pollock Pines, where their home has a panoramic view of Jenkinson Lake and the surrounding hills. A few months ago, Hines learned that SPI has filed plans to clear cut three tracts on those hills, including one that will be 1,000 feet from Jenkinson Lake. Working with his neighbors, Hines had to scramble to meet the state's 15-day limit on responding to timber harvest plans. They made the deadline, but state foresters rejected their challenge. This is a farce, said Hines, a neighborhood watch leader in Pollock Pines. The public doesn't have the foggiest idea of what's going on until it's too late. As for the loggers, they have mixed feelings. Many support SPI but worry about the rising emotion of the protesters. Some say the company has been too aggressive in logging near areas sure to produce a backlash, such as Arnold's drinking water reservoir. Quote, I think they brought it on themselves by cutting so close to White Pines Lake, said Jason Priest, an Arnold logger who recently spent a Wednesday clearing an SPI tract in Tuolumne County. Asked what kind of logging he preferred, Press cracked a smile. I like selective logging, he said, wiping his brow. There's more shade. And that's our commentary for today. Let's move right into news. The District of Columbia Circuit Court has upheld a decision preventing the transfer of federal land for use as a nuclear dump near traditional Indian lands on the California-Arizona border. A proposal to build a low-level nuclear waste dump at a site known as Ward Valley has been the subject of controversy for almost 20 years. In order for the proposal to move forward, the land has to be transferred to California. A private company known as U.S. Ecology has been hoping to develop the site, but was stopped short by a decision preventing transfer. Literally a day before he left office in January of 1993, Secretary of Interior Manuel Lujan Jr. approved the transfer. But a month later, Bruce Babbitt, the current and soon outgoing secretary, rescinded the order. The rescindment led to a lawsuit filed in 1997 by both the State of California Department of Health Services and U.S. Ecology. Current Governor Gray Davis opted to bow out in 1999 after a lower court ruled the state could not force the land transfer. The court has recently dismissed U.S. Ecology's lawsuit because the company lacks standing to bring the case. The refusal of the courts to let the company challenge the Interior Department has left the Ward Valley proposal effectively dead. Forest lands in Washington's Cascade Mountains will receive additional protections through a $10.7 million federal outlay approved by the Congress. The additional federal appropriation, which will come out of the Interior Department's discretionary budget, will be used to protect a total of 6,400 acres of critical forest habitat throughout the Cascades. The additional federal outlay will go into a fund managed by the Cascades Conservation Partnership, which has raised almost $30 million to protect the region. The additional $10.7 million will go to protect 1,700 acres of forest, much of it old growth in Fossil Creek just west of Mount St. Helens. The entire appropriation will protect a total of 6,400 acres of critical forest habitat this year. The partnership's three-year goal is to raise a total of $125 million to maintain and enhance critical wilderness and wildlife corridors linking the North and South Cascades. Most of the land is currently owned by Plum Creek Timber Company, which has expressed an interest in selling the land. The land will be protected from roading and logging and will be managed by the U.S. Forest Service. The 6,400 acres that the group wants to protect includes 1,400 acres of old growth and ancient forests in Washington's Central Cascades, 726 acres of old growth and ancient forests just west of Mount St. Helens, and 3.5 miles of the Yakima River, which contains wild king salmon spawning habitat. The group is also eyeing land in the Kendall Peak Lakes area, as well as 2.5 miles of hiking trails just south of Kikilis Lake. Moving south, a tanker spilled more than 500,000 gallons of crude oil into the lower Mississippi River a month or two ago, one of the largest oil spills in U.S. waters since the Exxon Valdez dumped more than 10 million gallons in Alaska in 1989. The spill near Port Sulphur, Louisiana, is about 70 miles inland from the Gulf of Mexico and 25 miles upriver from the Delta National Wildlife Refuge and a state wildlife management area where about 200,000 migratory waterfowl make their winter homes. Cleanup crews have so far kept oil out of sensitive wetlands by setting up floating booms, but some birds have already been affected. A single-hulled Westchester, a Liberian-owned tanker registered in the Bahamas, ran aground after an explosion in its engine room caused a power failure. And a few months ago, Florida Governor Jeb Bush pleasantly surprised environmentalists by saying that his administration would not approve any marina expansions in counties without solid plans to protect endangered manatees. But Bush has now gone back on his word. Bush and his cabinet quietly approved a project that had publicly blocked in July, an expansion plan for the Sarasota Yacht Club, even though Sarasota County still doesn't have a manatee protection plan. There are only about 2,200 to 2,500 manatees left in Florida waters, and many of them are killed each year in collisions with boats. And President Clinton has signed legislation to restore the Florida Everglades, aimed at reviving millions of acres of sawgrass prairies, mangrove and cypress swamps, hardwood hammocks, and coral reefs. The proposed 30-year, $7.8 billion effort will now begin to restore the ailing River of Grass, an effort that had bipartisan support in Congress and had been a major environmental priority for the administration. The comprehensive restoration plan will return a natural flow of water through the Everglades, which has seen over 70% of its historic flows diverted to supply water to farms and communities, and roughly half its acres lost to agriculture and development. Clinton signed the Water Resources Development Act of 2000, authorizing the Comprehensive State Everglades Restoration Plan. The plan seeks to nearly double the amount of fresh water available in South Florida, ensuring plentiful flows for the Everglades and adequate supplies for the region's cities and farms, administration officials said. The administration cited several problems. Roughly half of the Everglades has been lost to agriculture and development. Populations of wading birds have plummeted 90%. Scores of species are gone or, like the American crocodile and Florida panther, in danger of extinction. At the same time, the region's population is projected to double by the 2050, and continued environmental decline threatens to undermine the region's thriving tourist economy, administration officials said. Key features of the restoration plan include raising 20 miles of highway and removing 240 miles of levees and canals to help natural sheet flows, 181,000 acres of above-ground reservoirs with a capacity of 1.5 million acre-feet, 300 wells to store and retrieve water from underground aquifers, 35,000 acres of wetlands to naturally filter polluted runoff, and reuse of 220 million gallons a day of wastewater. The administration said the plan will generate an additional 1.1 million acre-feet of water a year when completed. 80% of the new water will be committed to environmental restoration, while the remaining 20% ensures adequate supplies for cities and farms through the year 2050. Rebuilding the region's water system to more closely mimic nature's design will help restore more than 2.5 million acres of the South Florida ecosystem, the administration said, as well as improve the health of Lake Okeechobee, the second largest freshwater lake in the continental United States. The restoration plan is intended to increase flows to the Everglades National Park and revive Florida Bay and the coral reefs off the Florida Keys. And the California Coastal Commission approved a giant project to lay fiber optic cables throughout the California coastal zone. The plan is to lay cable in state and federal waters along the entire coast, with coastal landings at four beaches: Morro Bay in San Luis, Leadbetter Beach in Santa Barbara, Manhattan Beach in Los Angeles, and Mission Beach in San Diego. Various parts of the project include burying cable from mean high tide line to, on average, 10 miles offshore, boring 10 conduits, two each at Morro Bay, Santa Barbara, and Manhattan Beach, and one at San Diego under the seafloor from shore, and surfacing in approximately 30 to 60 feet of water, and pulling the cable onshore in San Diego in existing underground conduits for a distance of approximately 2.5 miles. A major coastal act issues related to the project included potential impacts to marine resources, including mammals and commercial fishing. Lynn Gaffney of the Center for Marine Conservation, speaking on behalf of CMC and Save Our Shores, made 3 points in opposition to the project. First, Gaffney addressed the fact that the entire project was not before the commission, only the part affecting Southern and Central California. The company hopes to build a similar network in Northern California. Informed decision-making requires the projects and its impacts to be reviewed in total, Gaffney argued. Gaffney also reminded the commission that all previous cable projects reviewed by the commission were international in scope and were required to traverse coastal environments in order to meet larger international connections. This project, on the other hand, serves only California communities. The point is that the commission, while approving this project, is setting a precedent of using the ocean as a utility corridor for in-state serving public utilities. Lastly, Gaffney again criticized the commission for the failure to do a comprehensive cumulative impacts analysis. This is the sixth cable project approved this year in the California coastal zone. Many more will be proposed over the next decade. This project was not required to prepare an environmental impact report. None of the projects undertook research to analyze impacts of the other projects or future projects. Worse, the state of California has no strategy whatsoever for consolidating or anticipating or coordinating these proposals and projects. As Coastwatcher has stated on numerous occasions, these projects may have a relatively short lifespan. Just what will happen to thousands of miles of old cables across the bottom of the ocean is an important unanswered question. It is highly unlikely they will ever be removed. Indeed, removal can be a very dangerous job. One worker was recently killed in San Diego when a cable being removed broke in half and snapped back at the boat. Utah Carbon County's Timber Rules Curb Logging and Protect Lands, written by Lane Miller of the Salt Lake City Tribune. Carbon County Utah has become one of the first counties in the state of Utah to adopt an ordinance regulating the harvesting of timber on private land. The measure was taken to protect and preserve ground and surface water in the county, reduce the potential for fire hazards and spread of damage from insect epidemics and other problems, says County Commissioner Bill Crumple. We had reports that some operators trespassed on private land, completely changed the location of county roads, stole timber, removed cattle guards, and caused mudslides because the trees were completely removed, says Crumple. In other cases, private landowners were paid about one-third the price for their timber that more savvy owners like State Institutional Trust Land Administration would have received. Crumple points out that millions of board feet of timber remain in the county, especially in the Range Creek area of the Book Cliffs and in the Schofield area. The county is different from many rural Utah counties because only about 62% of it is owned by the federal government, compared to some counties which are 90% federally owned. Crumple says the county will hire a county forester to enforce the timber ordinance, which is funded with $30,000 from the county and $10,000 from the state. Under the ordinance, commercial timber operators are required to submit a harvest plan to the county and purchase a permit. Among the list of 16 requirements, the plan must describe where logging will take place, the extent of forest stands to be cut, location of streams, the type of logging to be done, such as thinning or clear cutting, a road plan for operations, and location of the logging camp. We support timbering, says Crumple, but we don't support timbering that results in pollution of our waterways and especially increasing the beetle infestations that is taking place in our forests. The need to take protective measures comes as a closed lumber mill located in Wellington, 7 miles southeast of Price, Utah, has resumed operations. Crumple says in the final 4 years before it ceased operations, the county helped supply the mill, which had processed between 20 and 25 million board feet of timber a year. Officials say the lack of statewide regulations covering logging on private property in Utah makes it difficult to track how many acres of land are being impacted. State Forester Art DeFault points to at least one mountain peak between East Carbon and Range Creek, a tributary of the Green River, as an example of why regulations are needed. They have denuded the mountaintop, says DeFault. They set up a cable system and removed all the trees on those steep slopes, and it's not prohibited. And unusual snowless conditions have allowed a 9,000-acre wildfire to burn on the tundra of western Alaska, federal officials said recently. Firefighters were monitoring the blaze, which is located on the southern edge of Norton Sound near the mouth of the Yukon River, about 430 miles northwest of Anchorage. The fire is burning in the Yukon Delta National Wildlife Refuge. The closest settlement is Kotlik, a Yupik Eskimo village of about 450 people located 20 miles to the west of the fire. No threats to people or property have been identified, but the fire is being watched because of concerns about critical wildlife habitat in the refuge, says Andy Williams, spokesman for the Alaska Fire Information Center. Alaska's normal wildfire season is in late spring and early summer, when full greenery has yet to bloom. A winter fire is an oddity, Williams said, and we thank the Reuters News Service for that article.
And that's about all the time we have for news. To get news or announcements from your bioregion to Earth First Radio, send us email at cruzeef@cruzio.com. That's cruzeef@cruzio.com. Or send a letter to Earth First Radio, P.O. Box 344, Santa Cruz, California, 95061. That address again, Earth First Radio, P.O. Box 344, Santa Cruz, California, 95061, and be sure to send any and all announcements at least 3 weeks in advance so Uncle Dennis can get them on the air in a timely fashion. If you want more in-depth news and information about the Earth First Movement, please subscribe to the Earth First Journal. Their current address, soon to change, but currently is P.O. Box 1415, Eugene, Oregon, 97440. As soon as we get that new address, we'll let you know. But currently, it's the Earth First Journal, P.O. Box 1415, Eugene, Oregon, 97440. You can listen to Earth First Radio live on the Internet every Thursday night at 8 p.m. Go to the website www.microradio.net/FRSC and listen in. There's lots of great shows on Free Radio Santa Cruz anytime. And if you missed that live show, you can always find Earth First Radio archive shows on the World Wide Web at www.radioforall.net. That's www.radio4all.net. Earth First Radio is carried on a growing number of free speech and non-commercial radio stations. Please ask your local station to rebroadcast Earth First Radio. Earth First Radio is produced in the studios of Free Radio Santa Cruz. Our theme music was written and performed by Daryl Cherney from the CD Keep It Wild. I'm Uncle Dennis. I want to thank you for listening.
And now let's listen to a selection from Danny Dolinger's CD, Rome Wasn't Burnt in a Day. This one's called Walking in Power.
Something pulls you out of bed and puts you in your day and introduces you to everything you need along the way. It puts your finger to the flame and teaches you the burning, and you become a ripple in the river of our learning. It locks you at the gateway of your dreams until the hour you recognize you've always had the key and you are walking in power. Most folks can't see power unless it is in motion. I see fire in your eyes to move the tide across the ocean. There's a purpose in your passion, there's a reason for your tears. Yet you dissipate your power when you ground it in your fears. You will step into destiny and you can do it now, or stumble blindly down your path like you don't know that you are walking in power. Light the way for those who come behind you. There's more to your future than the choices you have made. So don't be afraid. Don't be afraid. There is power when you stay. There is power when you go. There is power in the people who are not aware they know. Do not give your power to the cynics who would bind you. It is you and you alone who has confined you. Someone tried to steal away the light that lets you flower, but you are always safe when you're aware that you are walking in power. When you accept your light, you are never in the dark. There is guidance for the asking if you listen with your heart. And this will bring you to the very things you want the most. But if you want to sing with angels, gotta dance with ghosts. Show compassion for the people who still tremble and cower. It was not so long ago you didn't know